So, last few weeks, really, nothing, like, we're not doing anything as far as gaming. It's been kind of a lull.
It's been kind of a lull, yeah, ever since Sean's last Nova Praxis game, we haven't had anything. I'm kind of in the middle of a weird dead zone with myself, where I'm still trying to scrape together what I want to do with the rest of my plot. I've got a lot of, like, puzzle pieces, and I'm just trying to fit them together in a way that's fun and dramatic for you guys, but also satisfying.
Fair enough.
And I've also really been struggling with a lot of, I don't know if it's just seasonal depression or if it's just, you know, the world sucks or whatever, but, like, none of my hobbies feel fun anymore, you know, so just kind of doing that thing of, like, I should get back to my game. Then nothing happens.
For me, it's been, like, I've been trying to get together with my Tiny D6 stuff and, like, this is what I want to do and get that feeling locked in, and then out of nowhere, you know, it's just something new will happen, and now I just don't have any bandwidth. Like, the last couple weeks of just event after event has kept me from really taking time to break it down and make sure I'm getting what I need ready, or even just picking dates. Like, I've been doing this class, and it's, you know, now it's, you know, I'm 4 weeks into it, so I've got 4 weeks left, and then I'm going to be taking a test at the end of it, and that just feels ominous. So it's like, I don't want to plan anything until that, and then immediately following that, we've got other events coming up at, in April, in May, and
you've
in
got
June.
My wedding, so I've been planning for that, so that's been consuming some of my time and energy, so and just,
It feels like maybe I do need to just wait till July, and let it all blow over, wait till July, and then pick back up and be like, okay, here's what we're doing.
That sounds good. I don't think trying to force it into an already packed schedule where you're going to be strained for energy and attention does anybody any good, including yourself.
Correct. So I'm just going to take the time, take a half year off, you know.
Also, something set boundaries.
Something, you know? Like that.
Yeah.
Something like, but I, like, at the same time, like, it is my creative release.
Yeah.
And I don't have that right now, so it makes me feel like half or a quarter of a person, you know, so I don't have a good way to handle that, and that sucks. That sucks. So.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
But we have this. For now.
for now. Yeah.
But this week, we actually are pulling together things that, games and systems, ideas that we had that we haven't seen.
Yeah, we had a bit of a creative outlet just speculating here. It was kind of an interesting topic for me because, I mean, I was like sick yesterday and stuff like that, but, like, even all week I've been trying to come together with, like, systems that I would love to see, right? With the premise being that I haven't seen them before and that they probably don't exist.
Right.
And the problem that I was having is, after 5 years of doing this, I was like, oh, wait, wouldn't it be cool if there's a... Wait, no, that's just Star Trek Adventures.
No, we know that, yeah.
Okay, well, what if, and hear me out, that... Oh, wait, no, that's just Blades in the Dark. Okay, hold on. finding game systems that don't exist, or don't exist at least in some form conceptually, is extraordinarily difficult.
It's weird, because you have to kind of decide whether or not it is the thing that you're looking for, more than just a setting, right? Because I think for me, it is more than just the setting. In fact, it often is a specific point within it. Like, for instance, I think Plangea does a great job of this, right? Plangea isn't just a dinosaur world D&D game.
Sure.
Right? It's a survival game, and it has tribes and relationship. But it's that visceral survivability in that alien environment makes it unique. That, like, it's not just the other people you're against. Literally the world wants to eat you or break you down in some way. And that creates that level of tension that you need for something like that. So that's the kind of thing I was leaning into when I was thinking about this, was... What is it that, A, we've learned from systems, from going through our system spotlights, that make us think that there should be something like X, right?
Then,
is X really fulfilled by something that's out there that we know of that it might be like.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, one of the very first ones that kind of came to mind when I was thinking about this was, I like 7th Sea. I like it for what it is, but there's a courtly kind of thing that happens in 7th Sea, where you've got these negotiations and boons and, like, you're trying to throw people off their game and get favors from others. You know, it's not about whether they like you. It's not about the romance. Like, those are all side things.
Yeah.
It's favor to favor. It's mm-hmm. deed to deed, you know. It's, I did this for this person over here who I know you need help from. You know, it's practically like the swap shop kind of idea.
Yeah.
But it's happening in a courtly environment with all those types of people involved.
Sounds like what Vampire always said that it was supposed to be.
See, and that's the point that I'm trying to make here is that you think Vampire, but you know the system.
I know it doesn't. Yeah.
Just like we know D&D isn't a group of people sitting around a bar talking about their exploits.
Yeah.
It's a combat system.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, Red Dragon Inn does a better job of that, and it's a freaking board game. You know?
Right, yeah.
But the point is that, like, what our perception of a game is isn't necessarily the game that we're really wanting. So, coming back to the courtly thing, I called it courtly encounters, was the idea kind of behind it. You know, it's not romance. It's mm-hmm. a social interaction more than just the positive and negatives of those relationships. You know, it is the debts, the favors, the boons, some of the mechanics that 7th Sea does have, and a few other systems have. Like, you could slap all that together. That's the crunch.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the crunch happens, is, like, are you getting the resources you need to achieve a goal?
Yeah.
That's in there. Like, you know, maybe you, and I'm theoretically just posturing here that you're all playing courtiers of different low ranks, mm-hmm. right? You have patrons who are putting you into play, right, to do what they ask you to do, not unlike, you know, a Johnson or something like that.
Sure.
But also, you're trying to raise your own status so you don't need them, that you already have, like, maybe Simple Simon.
Okay.
The fairy tale, Simple Simon.
I don't think I'm familiar with it, actually.
The other one is, put in his thumb, pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy am I.
Little
Jack Horner.
Little Jack Horner, yeah.
Which was a legitimate historical event that occurred,
mm-hmm.
Where he actually, the plum was a plumbum or a deed to an estate.
Oh, okay.
And he basically, what was happening was that people were sending stuff to the regent via food.
Mm-hmm.
To basically secretly get favor beyond the open court.
Okay.
Where people could hear things. So they were sending him deeds, they were sending him writs, they were sending him other things like that. And so Jack Horner, who was delivering these things, one day was just like, let's see what's in this one.
Stuck
and so
in
he
his
was
thumb.
Pulled out a plum. Said, what a good boy am I.
Uh-huh.
And the whole idea is that he stole some things from the magistrate, but, like, nobody could say that he did it because it shouldn't have been happening in the first place.
It's that line, that great line from The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, where he says, what am I supposed to do? Accuse him of cheating better than me?
Yes. And there's something to be said for that, in the sense that, and I'm sorry if you guys are hearing some background noises as well. There's something going on with my pipes apparently as well. God, it's just a weird day. In any case, The idea being that it's this kind of complex game that you're playing that has to do with, in some levels, attraction, manipulation, coercion, intrigue, that draws you to be able to win these effects, to be able to move yourself forward. And I was trying to find any comparable set that, like, of standard mechanics that would work.
Mm-hmm.
That would fit for this. And funny enough, as I was running across that, I came across the game Court of Blades, which is a Forged in the Dark system that's similar.
Right,
it doesn't meet all the requirements, but it is similar enough, and I can understand that because Forged in the Dark works with the idea of gaining resources
mm-hmm.
in a within a a known field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Blades in the Dark specifically deals with this in the sense that you're basically gaining ground.
In the city, right? It's a turf war sort of thing.
Right.
But we've seen that, that pirate Forged in the Dark one, which was all control of various islands and
waterways,
sea territories.
And ports and things. Yeah, exactly. So moving it from a territorial system
to a courtly influence thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Some people of the channel may know the game Love Letter. Is another one. Funny enough, if you look at the side of the box, you'll see that it's AEG, which is 7C.
It's a 7C setting, yeah.
Very, very similar of where that all came from. But the point of the matter is that it's still not exactly what my idea was, but it might be a start point.
Yeah, it sounds like a great start point, honestly.
Yeah.
And now, for something like this, would you want it to be a 7C extension? Because I know you really love the setting, or would you want it to be, like your typical Dungeons and Dragons fantasy style with, maybe some of your elves and your dwarves and stuff like that in there? Or
I would almost say that it would. I think it could be fantasy or contemporary or historical fantasy, agnostic.
Okay.
Like, it could be either.
Sure.
But I could also see this being used in, like, a spacefaring thing like Dune.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Battletech has nobles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, again, that's another one of the situations where, like, we leave the war to the warlords.
Right.
There's points where that can get put into play, but it has very different inclinations, you know?
Yeah, the mech warriors think they're the ones making the decisions out there on the battlefield, but whole worlds are won and lost in a conversation in this room.
Correct.
Yep.
Correct.
Yep.
And that's the exact feeling that I was kind of going for in the design of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
very cool. Very cool. I would give that a look. I'm intrigued by the idea of a courtly politics game that is kind of like where all of your rules are based around those courtly politics that kind of numericize, I think is the word, give them numerical value and such like that. I'm reminded a lot of games like Monster Hearts and I think Urban Shadows did this and stuff like that, where you'd have strings.
Yes.
Attached to people when they shared something with you, you would gain a string on them. Mm-hmm. I see that as sort of a mechanic you'd be leaning into of like, oh, well, you do owe me a favor for that thing that I did with that thing that one time in that place.
And my thought is that I would probably lean into the playbook design for characters versus a class-based system where you are a trope of a courtier.
Yeah.
Like, are you the musician? Are you a rich noble?
Are you a fop? Are you a merchant?
Are you a powerful merchant class? Are you a skulldugger? Are you not meant to be here? Are you the military man? Are you the knight?
Yeah.
Of the court kind of a thing. And each one of those would have its own, obviously, bonuses and withdrawals of circles that coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your start point and how far you drift from those circles.
That that man in the shadows trope.
Yeah.
Walsingham? I don't know the name of the character, but okay. I want to say it was like some sort of a Queen Victoria thing where there was just some character that was just like, don't worry about me. I'm nobody. But I'm here on behalf of this important person,
Walsingham was that person to Elizabeth.
That sounds right. So. That sounds right then, yes.
Yeah. I love the Walsingham character that gets thrown into stories. But yes, he is a person of nobody, but yet of unbelievable power.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yep, exactly.
He reminds me a lot of Mike from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's
I had a guy, but now I don't.
Yeah. Did you want to grab one?
Here's one we kind of like came to together. Because you had one angle you kind of came at this from. I had another angle I kind of came at this from. And if you think way back to when we reviewed Arc Doom, I thought of this as kind of a concept out loud then. And the concept was sort of the players would be part of an organization that exists outside of reality.
Okay.
And so you would have very much like, I think maybe like the TVA from the Marvel universe, they exist kind of in this pocket dimension.
Sure.
And they have access to all these different timelines and realities and stuff like that.
Okay.
And their job is essentially to go into these realities and sort out what is breaking them.
Okay.
Less So the TVA is kind of like, oh, well, this one's not, you know, conforming to the main timeline, so we're going to prune it.
Right.
Whereas these ones are like, this one, my concept is more in the opposite, in that it's like something is breaking this timeline and verging it hard off into an apocalypse. What do we need to send some agents there, and they need to figure out what's wrong, and they need to resolve it. And they're imbued with certain powers to do so. And I really like the very captivated by that whole idea of like a, maybe like Sliders or Quantum Leap or something like that, where you're every adventure you're going into a new setting, a new reality with new characters, and your character may bounce from a medieval society to a space age society to a cyberpunk society.
Okay.
So this sort of game would span all genres, and you would need mechanics that would support a character that could easily transplant between those sort of things.
Okay. So what would you be doing? Are you feeling this is a combat system or more of like an investigative?
Well, I think it would definitely be investigative.
Okay. Okay.
Because I mean, at least for me right now, and I'm sure I'll talk about this a little bit more later. I'm rebelling really hard against combat systems right now.
You are.
As evidenced by last episode. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think the solution to everything should be kill it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think find out what is going wrong and try to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
Can be a peaceful, can be an investigative, can be even a cherished good thing.
Yeah, I agree. My angle on the whole investigative thing sits more like in the Brindlewood Bay,
mm-hmm.
except removing it from that and doing the same thing of putting it through time, almost like a Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, where like you're pulled out of your time to solve a problem somewhere else, pulling the world's best investigators.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Like, you know, you have your Sherlock Holmes who shows up there, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe the Mata Hari shows up, you know, maybe, Inspector Clouseau.
Yeah.
You get all these different investigators that get pulled out of time regularly, right? And to help solve points in time that are in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this happens, we're going to lose, like, a whole section of time. Like, you know, you probably are aware that the, you know, Library of Alexandria burned to the ground. Yes. Okay. That has to happen. And these people are literally protecting it. And if they don't, you know, if this happens, everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
Like the timeline is irreparably damaged. So it must burn. Like, you know, you need to go and figure out who's in on this that doesn't belong here.
Because
someone here doesn't belong. Like someone here is trying to alter the time space.
I'm feeling this sharp pain as if thousands of librarians suddenly cried out in pain and then were suddenly silenced.
Yeah, but I mean, and the thing is that the concept that I had behind this, and it was really kind of brilliant, was I watched someone explain why you don't dig channels to connect rivers or rivers to other bodies of water.
Mm-hmm.
You let it happen naturally.
Okay.
So we do it, but we do it under an engineering logic.
Sure, sure,
right?
Sure.
Like you figure out what's really going on.
You do the
there.
Damn math first, yeah.
Because if you don't, you do not know how bad the consequences can be.
Oh, I imagine the erosion is incalculable.
Yeah. And a guy showed someone who had literally just dug a 18-foot-long trench between his houses, like he had a pond.
Mm-hmm.
To this little culvert river because he wanted to refill the pond. And it...
destroyed his house?
Worse.
Oh, wow.
He did not understand flow dynamics.
Okay.
That night, yeah, he had a little stream coming through, and then he had footage 3 days later of that riverbed that went on dry, and him and his neighbors all dealing with it going down the culvert and tearing their road out.
Oh, jeez.
Bit by bit.
Yeah.
Because it was steady flow.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening was that river had dammed in several places along it and was creating a slower flow. But once the flow picked up, it tore out dams upstream as well of small beaver dams and things like that.
Oh,
and
no.
Changed the entire flow of the river.
Oh, wow. And it's so, literally the butterfly effect in real life.
And
yeah.
Worst part about it was civil engineers had to come in and slowly move it back.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew it would just completely trash the ecosystem again to just turn it back on.
Yep.
And it was, he's just like, well, what are we going to do? Like, your road's out for the next month while we fix the problem
that
you caused. It was like, okay, well, that's an interesting concept, but like, yeah, just getting the right people in the right place to solve that.
Oh, I imagine, yeah.
So when I was thinking about that, I was like, okay, like if we're gonna do this, what systems do I know? Like, the first one I came to was Brindlewood Bay because it's a light system.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't focus hard on what's and where, right?
It seems very transplantable.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it handles mystery investigation and stuff like that is next to none.
Right. And I liked that. I liked some of the side chemistry that it put in there about them returning to home and thing like that, that add those extra elements to it. But also, like, Gumshoe is a great base system for
Gumshoe
investigation.
Always comes up when investigation comes up, and I've never looked at the system so far. So
yeah, I gave it a good look a while back when we were actually doing our episode on in mystery and investigation.
Oh, okay.
And I've got some notes back there in that episode. Funny enough, but it is a good investigative system. It comes highly recommended. But like all good things, it focuses on what it is. And so I like that we have hit this point after 5 years to be able to examine things like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And be able to have this plethora of things. But also to say, it literally took me 5 minutes to find Time Watch.
Right.
Which was a system that literally is what we both kind of talked about.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is grand. And it's out there. It's a thing. And I looked at it and I'm like, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good system.
Yeah.
So I was laughing about it.
Yeah. Arc Doom was the one I was going to reach for, obviously.
Honestly, for what you're doing, I think it fits better.
Because there's a doom clock. Correct. And it was going in to fix an apocalyptic reality.
Yeah. As much as I want to steal from Pangea, it's the metal that makes that game. That the fact that it's coming to an end and you have to stop that.
We're already at red alert. Your team has been deployed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. Yeah, we haven't hit DEFCON 1 yet, but we're at 2.
But we're at 2. And my finger's on the damn button.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, moving away from that, a long time ago, in your game, your D&D game, you did a Battle of the Bards as a side episode.
Yeah, you guys were just on the road heading from one major city to the other, and I decided to do a filler episode.
And I thought, what about a game that's just a battle of the bands?
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's literally just a kids on bikes, but with a band.
The moment you started talking about this to me earlier, it immediately struck a chord with me that this is essentially what the campaign mode of Rock Band is like.
Yeah.
And that seems hella fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of drama, you know.
Mm-hmm. But to have it, and so as I was breaking it down, I was like, okay, so I want it to feel like the history of a rock band. So maybe there's like three genres. There's the new indie band who's looking to get their first real gig. You've got your existing band that's been touring, but now they're getting a label that's interested in them.
Okay.
And then you have your aged band that's on the brink of self-destruction. How do they recover, or will they?
The record company's going to give us lots of money and everything's going to be all right.
Yes, exactly. But the whole idea is that it could be set in any setting, contemporary, older, fantasy, really doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah.
Mechanics, because you have like health would be like band cohesion.
Right, right.
You know, how well that's going. But even for the individual characters, I was thinking something back to like City of Mist, where you have like a balance between the ego of the band, like your persona on stage.
Right, versus
who you really are and what started the band, like what keeps you guys together,
what
when
keeps
you're
you
recording.
Grounded, yeah. Because like on one hand, you know, you look at like the ego of like the front man of the band can be a really great thing as a draw for attention and getting all this prestige and pulling people into your shows and what like that, but it hits a tipping point, you know, and I'm like reminded of like Roger Waters breaking off from Pink Floyd,
yeah,
where like when The Wall came out, he originally wanted that album to be called Roger Waters Presents Pink Floyd and The Wall, mm-hmm. or something. Yeah. Some, it was something that
it was ridiculous.
Roger Waters with Pink Floyd, or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. but like he kind of wanted to put himself as the front line, yeah. even over his own band, mm-hmm. and that was basically what caused the rift that got Roger Waters out of the band. You know,
yeah.
And I can absolutely see Ego having that, like, you need to keep it in check, but you kind of want it high, but you kind of don't, you know?
Right. And the playbooks are simple.
Yeah.
Right? It's you know, front man, rhythm, you know, bass line. Like, you have all the positions.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they all have benefits and deficits within mm-hmm. them and traits and things they can have. So it could work really well in something like Forge in the Dark.
Okay.
Or even to a degree, Fate. I was kind of thinking about Fate a little bit in this one.
I mean, Fate's a generic system. The good thing about Fate is that it is good for everything from a narrative standpoint.
Right, you know? Right. And so in that, I was like looking at, like, because it's Forge in the Dark is really good about making the assumption that you're already professionals at what you're doing.
Right. Yeah.
So
okay.
it's the struggles of each one of the things you build, and also Forge in the Dark does a really good job of giving you the layout. Of here's the map, right, mm-hmm. of what you need to do. How are you going to get through it?
Well, how do you see the map playing out in this system then?
It's about, like, who and where you can make your battles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's through the social networks, through the public, you know, through the, you know, between different record labels, or even, like, effectively the you know, your the social is like your actual fans and stuff like that versus your perception, right? The your vibe as far as the market is concerned. So, like, you almost the paparazzi and magazines and shit like that who are writing stories about you. So you've got different tracks that you can gain certain resources from by going and doing certain events. So it's like, maybe instead of just doing gigs, right, or shows, which are going to have their own combat, if you will,
sure.
achievement that you've got to do, you can also do things like, hey, we're going to do a spot for a sponsor,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, somebody's going to buy us for a weekend, and so we end up doing like a private corporate show,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, it makes us a lot of money, gets us some notoriety, but we're also selling out to the man in the process.
Yeah, it gets us the corporate shills debuff.
Right,
you know?
Exactly. And or do we go to a battle of the bands and hoping to get a signed contract, which is going to get us steady more shows? Like, we're already in line to do these other shows,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how well we do at them, we're going to get all of them.
Right, right.
But at the same time, like, we're locked into those. We have to do those.
Yeah, yeah,
no matter what happens.
Because you're contracted now.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And so I was like, okay, so I could see this going Forge in the Dark, but at the same time, I like that, like, your band cohesion is exceptionally important.
Mm-hmm.
That there's always a point where you're taking chances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you up, like, and that's what I was thinking, is like, when you're advancing, what do you advance about yourself versus what do you advance about the band?
Mm-hmm.
What risks do you take? So, like, it reminded me of the Savage World wealth mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're like, yeah, you want to push a little bit? You can roll. You could also lose.
Yeah, yeah.
You get what you wanted, but it cost you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? And so in that, like, instead of in most games where you're paying into the common thing,
mm-hmm.
you're stealing from it to see if you can achieve better.
Oh, okay.
So that common pool is something, if you take from it, you run a risk that you're gonna break band cohesion.
Yeah,
and it's gonna push you closer to Ego or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I like this a lot.
That's...
Like, there's some neat mechanics in it, and again, like, the idea of your monster being a set list.
Right, right, right. Right. See, and that was the thing that immediately then struck me afterwards was after I thought, wow, this sounds like the campaign mode in Rock Band. I then thought to myself, you know, Dread uses a Jenga tower. What's to say that the battle for tonight is going to be a three-song set in Rock Band? Now, mind you, not everybody has Rock Band, you know, but you yourself have
mm-hmm,
a pretty decent setup and a projector set up to full screen that damn thing in, like, 4K, you know,
yeah.
whatever. So it's a party activity for us over here. We would be able to set it up. You got the pro drums and everything, man.
I do.
It's ridiculous.
I do. It's fun. But funny enough, did a light search and found Rockopolis.
Rockopolis. How about that? This already exists.
It's a D6 system uh-huh. that has feats and bonds, and it's interesting. And like I honestly looked at it and gave it a pretty quick scan, but at the same time, it had like Savage World vibes.
Yeah, sure. I like it already.
Throughout it, I was like, this is a cool design. I like it.
Uh-huh.
It's now granted, its setting is different. The mm-hmm. whole world is a rock world, and
sure.
it's all about the combat. But like, the system was really neat, and uh-huh. I'll give it props. But like, it itched the edge of what I was looking at.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I thought that was a neat way to mm-hmm. step into it. So
yeah. All right, so one of mine here, and I think I talked about this a little bit before in a previous episode, I think, too, is I'm big into space exploration.
Yes.
I've played Elite Dangerous for quite a while,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and my favorite ship, as much as I've fallen out with the game, the ship mm-hmm. still holds a special place in my heart, just warms it whenever mm-hmm. I think about it, is that Diamondback Explorer.
Yeah.
Just this little one-seater exploration vehicle. Mm-hmm. Second largest jump drive in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Only second because technically you can core out an Anaconda, which is the biggest ship in the game, and
yeah.
turn it into nothing but a flying fuel tank, and it gets like 2 light years further than the Diamondback does.
Yeah, I actually got I remember using my Anaconda for most of the exploration stuff because it could hold. Actual hold, it had still had hold and could push the distances.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but just going out like into the black and mm-hmm. just finding strange new things and mm-hmm. just you know having that be your adventure.
Watching your tank get real low and hoping for a star. Yeah.
Well, not even hoping for a star, man. Just the exhilaration of like finally finding that star and then just dipping in on it and deploying your fuel scoop.
Yeah.
And then just watching your heat gauge get a little hotter and a little hotter and a little hotter. But your fuel tank getting fuller and fuller,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then pulling off of it as you're loading up your next coordinates and just boom in one
yep.
smooth motion, just jump, gone. Making that, you know, powering up the frameshift drive and just jumping out in mm-hmm. black again, you know,
yep.
Just great. Just absolutely great. I love mm-hmm. that feeling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as aforementioned, I'm rebelling really hard against combat systems nowadays.
Yeah.
And I think this all kind of comes to a head in a lot of different things. I was mentioning earlier that, like, Starfield mm-hmm. recently came mm-hmm. out, and I was really disappointed with it. But
yeah.
not for, like, the typical reasons of, like, Bethesda copying and pasting their same game just into space, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, like, they really presented this great sort of aesthetic of, like, NASA punk, you know, 1,000 planets to explore. It's like, come out here and feel the wonders of the universe. But then when the game came out, it was like, here's your gun. You can go fight bandits, or you
yeah.
can go fight pirates, or you can go fight aliens.
Yeah.
You know? Or you can do fetch quests, I guess.
Sure.
But, like, there's nothing really to explore because most of these planets are just empty anyways. You know? Or we just fast travel you to, you know, 500 meters away from where you're supposed to be, and you're going to walk across a rocky landscape to get there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's not really exploration, you know? There's no wonder in it. There's no discovery in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really getting, like, sort of emergent gameplay out of finding and interacting with strange things you didn't expect to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, and opening up new opportunities and new problems that you have to find creative solutions for. And that's ultimately what I would be looking for, is
mm-hmm.
I'm looking for a space exploration game that kind of gives me that that same sort of Star Trek vibe of, like, we're not out here to kill things. We're out here to see new things, to learn new things, to meet new people, meet
mm-hmm.
new civilizations, to
mm-hmm.
come back home tomorrow knowing more about our universe than we did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, admittedly, Star Trek Adventures is basically what this game is.
I could see that.
To an extent, you know?
Right.
But I think Star Trek Adventures comes with the baggage of carrying with it the Star Trek universe.
Correct.
And admittedly, the Star Trek universe has, as much as it loves to purport that it's about a progressive, you know, futuristic society and such like that, has gotten a little bit combative. It's broken, like, Deep Space Nine broke one of its cardinal rules. There's no war in Star Trek.
There's war.
There's war. There's a whole plot line
about
it.
In fact, there's several war.
And it's a great plot line, the Dominion War. Like, it's one of my favorite plot lines in all of Star Trek. But, like, they've really kind of strayed from that, and they're a little more trigger happy and a little less willing to just say, hey, let's talk this out with diplomacy or with finding common ground between our societies and whatnot. And I think there's a lot of gameplay to be had there with just meeting strange people, strange alien life forms possibly, or just strange cultures, even if they are human, and trying to come to some common ground and find a good solution for it.
The Orville, I think, does a really good job of balancing that combat versus exploration, because they lean heavily into, like, we're not here for the combat.
Right.
In fact, most times they're not. We're the weakest people in the fucking galaxy.
They are. They are.
Like, we need help constantly.
God, I cannot remember the names of those two factions, but there's that warlike faction with the pasty white skin.
Yeah.
And then there's the automatons that are coming after them. And I mean, with both of them, they're both like, we are going to get wiped out. We have to find a diplomatic solution right now, you know? The only thing holding these people off is that the Moklins have all of the weapons.
Yeah.
And honestly, they're kind of jerks.
Yeah.
And we don't really like them, but we can't tell them to take a hike because they've got all the weapons.
Exactly.
I think interesting situations like that would be good. Like I said, so I think Star Trek Adventures probably covers most of this. Yeah, I think you can play Star Trek Adventures in a way that facilitates this.
And I think that's the key to this one is that one thing that I was trying to dig out of you was what does... I guess my two questions, which come out of most of our system spotlights, that what I was looking at is, what is the hit points of this game?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to gain and lose, right? And two, what does advancement look like? What do you gain and what does it cost?
Yeah, that's kind of the other thing of, like, you know, this is what is the purpose of the player characters? You know, what are you looking for out there?
Because the first question you have to ask is, why am I even doing this?
Yeah.
Why is my character doing this? And you can always say, like, well, it's the Star Trek thing. It's like, you've chosen this as your career.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I choose this career? Well, that's up to you.
Explore strange new worlds and new civilizations. Go boldly where no one's gone before. Yeah.
Right, but you still have to have a reason why you're doing that, and often that's a really gray area.
Yeah.
I mean, no different than the gray area of, like, I'm a fighter. Okay, why are you doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
what makes you a fighter? Like, why are you fighting?
I mean, I think making your characters scientists is probably the best move here.
Mm-hmm.
Because first off, it gives you a purpose,
mm-hmm.
but it makes that purpose non-combat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so I imagine you would find yourself in, you know, a situation like that moment in Firefly where he's like, they think a Firefly class ship has guns on it. Get this, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you don't even have any, you just have to bluff about it maybe, or negotiate around it, you know,
right.
Where combat almost isn't an option, where you have to find the alternate solutions because you don't have these sort of things, but your goal is to go out there and discover these things. You know, maybe you do work for a larger government that is looking to expand into space. Maybe resources are scarce and you're looking for equitable ways to achieve these resources, either through trade with some of the other civilizations that are out there, or by discovering uninhabited planets that you can exploit for them.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I haven't given it too much thought, but I just know that I need the core of the system to be this, like, non-combat.
Right, and that comes back to, so if your drive is something that can be different, then what's the hit points and what's the advancement look like? You don't have to answer these questions, but
I think they
sit in that frame of, does Star Trek Adventures fulfill those things? And if the answer is no, because its two core elements of hit points and an advancement don't meet, like, you look at them and you go, nope, that doesn't fit, then perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Then that's exactly where that's your shift.
Yeah.
So, and something like that. And so I think as you look at these and examine, you can quickly discount whether or not that system is going to work for you or not pretty fast.
Yeah.
Whether or not you have to shift from a different system that has those core values, maybe they're obscured by a different framework,
mm-hmm.
but they still are there, and now you can kind of reflavor it, if you will, we see all the time with Forge in the Dark.
Right, right. Yeah, and I hate to keep coming back to Forge in the Dark, but I could almost see this as a Forge in the Dark system, again, just simply because it does incorporate that sort of, like, territorial map system, and I think that works very well for a space exploration thing, the different factions less being rival gangs that you're going to be doing combat with, but more other societies that you will have diplomatic relations with, that you'll have trade agreements with and such like that. And so having, a claim over certain territory essentially means having good relations with them and getting some sort of a resource exchange with them, you know?
See, now I'm going to take a twist on this one for you completely, for something that you would not normally have done. And that is that something like a Stars Without Number world design, where it's you don't know what you're stepping into.
Okay.
None of the players at the table do. But on the table are play cards or playbooks of positions on the ship and maybe races, right? And then when you sit down at the table, this is the situation in the universe. Here are the people in the universe. Here are the planets that you just came in on. These are your people for the ship.
You're stuck with them. Congrats.
Yeah.
Go make a living for yourself.
Like, choose your people. Mm-hmm. Let's play out the scene.
Yeah.
And that way, because a starship is huge oftentimes, with hundreds of people, if not thousands.
Oh, see, no, I'd want a small, intimate little firefly.
Well, sure. But that would be, like, my shift on it is that every episode you could have some recurring characters.
Yeah, sure.
But the whole point of it is that you're stepping into a situation that is unknown, and that's part of it, is surviving through it, making the best of the situation, and moving on to the next one.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, sure, exploration is exploration at that point.
Yeah, I like that.
You just don't know if this week you're going to be the engineer, or next week you're going to be the, you know, the health officer, or the scientist.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Sure.
I like it.
All right.
You had mentioned one when we first started this, and then you forgot why.
You had jotted down a note, and the note in its totality was mech salvage survival. And this was apparently something I had an idea about and was very enthusiastic about.
You were very enthusiastic about this.
And so we come back to it these months later, and I'm like, I have no recollection of this place.
Exactly. Yeah, you pulled a Gandalf, and I had to poke you really hard a few times.
But we kind of worked it out, and I think where I was going with this was coming from a background with BattleTech.
Sure.
Okay. One of the things that I always found really compelling in that game system was the sort of the periphery life, you know, the hard knocks life of a small mercenary company out on the periphery trying to scrape together just enough money to buy fuel for the jump ship to get to their next contract so that they can not starve to death on the way there. You know? And having to make really tough decisions about, like, which mechs are you going to repair because you don't have enough money to repair them all.
You don't have the supplies. You don't have the money.
I guess I'm going to try to attach this Marauder arm onto the side of my Warhammer because they're roughly the same weight class and hope that it works because it's all I have, you know? And I really liked that. So I think I was thinking about a game system very much built around that concept.
Okay.
And it's what I'm tentatively calling Mad Mechs.
Okay.
You know, I want a mech survival, a mech piloting game, but with a Mad Max aesthetic.
Okay.
So whether this takes place on one world or whether there's multiple worlds, it's probably just one world that is a wasteland of some sort.
Sure.
But the world is a wasteland of some sort.
But there's not a lot of resources.
Okay. It's largely desert, so even things like water and food are a scarcity.
Okay.
Nuclear winter makes this easy to come about with, but, sure, you know, it could be any number of things.
Mm-hmm.
Mechs are the remaining bits of technology. So instead of it being guns and cars, it's smallish battle mechs that are like, I'll say glorified battle suits, you know, like maybe twice the size of a human being.
Okay.
You know? And that's kind of how we do warfare in the wasteland.
Okay.
But the thing is, I don't know if this game system would actually be fun, because just describing it makes it sound stressful to me.
Okay.
That as much as I hate crunchy systems, this would be a crunchy system, I think.
I think it could be.
Because I think keeping track of things like your food, your water, whether or not you have the people in your settlement to continue gathering food and water and repairing your mechs and things like that, are resources, you know?
Well, I definitely think you could have a hardcore mode that sits in that framework. Mm-hmm. But I also think, and here I do it again, Forge in the Dark has a very good framework for...
I know.
But at the same time, I don't even think you have to go that far, because if we look at something like Monster Care Squad, mm-hmm. right? Monster Care Squad has a whole very deep world that's going on,
mm-hmm.
right? But the action of what they're doing is what's important, and
yeah.
the effects of what that leads to. So if you squint really hard, you can drive this down to a very simplistic level,
mm-hmm.
of individuals who are a small group that's trying to step out and help this world, you know, help a small tribe survive,
mm-hmm.
and running into problems, right?
Yeah.
You could do it from the survival aspect of, I'm going to say it, of, like, Princess Mononoke,
mm-hmm.
where you have to leave the tribe because something's going on out there,
mm-hmm.
right? You must protect us because we can't keep this up and something's changed.
Right.
So now your group has to go out, you have to see who the problem is, you know, either negotiate with them, or maybe it'll come to blows and they don't want all out war. Nobody does.
Like, right.
They don't want you shooting a las cannon into their community.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone still handles this old Beshal rule set.
How dare you, refuse my Beshal.
Exactly. You know, but, you know, of fighting honorably. But at the same mm-hmm. time, like, there are these other hidden things that you can pull out. You know,
mech jock
things out in meta currencies or stuff like that. So, and it doesn't have to be turn-to-turn combat.
Yeah, that's the thing, is like I'm of two minds on this one, because I think anytime you start saying that you want, like, you know, cobbled together Mad Max style battle mechs, I think everybody starts getting very interested in what are the exact specs of this mech and what have you welded onto the side of it to make it combat worthy and whatnot, and you want to get into the minutia of things, but I almost see it as secondary.
Yeah,
I suppose
it's the setting.
It's secondary to the survival mechanics. I'm far more interested, I think, in the story told in, like, do you make the hard decision of, like, your settlement is running out of food and that neighboring tribe maybe hasn't been the greatest ally to you, but probably nothing that's, you know, boiled into open warfare, but they have food.
Yeah.
And you're starving, and you've got mechs.
Yeah,
you know, do you make the hard decision? Yeah, exactly. You know,
and what does that look like? What struggle does that create?
Right.
What unease does that create around them?
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
Or worse yet, you've got to leave. You're taking your people with you, and there's another group that realizes that you're going to be leaving your walls.
Mm-hmm.
So you're at risk.
Yep.
And so now, like, you're doing the Mad Max thing of trying to, like, jink them. Do you sacrifice one of your mechs to lead them off on a wild goose chase?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, does that pay off?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or how does it, what consequences does that lead to?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that is a whole nother level.
Yeah.
Like, you know, do you risk pushing a scout operation for an IFCOM because someone has a map that leads to an old facility?
Right.
That no one's seen
before. A lost tech cache or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, could be food, could be seeds, could be water.
Could be brand new battle mechs.
Could be.
You know?
You can't eat a battle mech, though.
Right, yeah.
And so, like, all
but
of
a brand
this...
spanking new one still in the box isn't gonna need repair for a while, at least.
Right,
though,
might not need a fuel core.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And those types of things where, like, you don't have to deal with the minutiae of the mech and how it's designed.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to say, it's a battle rating 4.
Right,
okay,
right,
done. Like, what does that mean? You can adjust the points any which way you want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's 4.
After every engagement, they all lose 1 rating.
Right.
But in salvage, you might gain a certain number of rating that you can redistribute to repair them.
You can't go higher than your current.
You just, you know? Well, you could. You could, because you could upgrade.
Right.
You could sell, you know, you could have an old busted autocannon on there, and you could salvage a brand spanking new LAS cannon and put it on there.
Well, my whole thought was is that you can't go higher than your the battle rating of the mech,
mm-hmm.
but you have the meta currency that gets stacked on top, which is basically your hijinks that you can do with it. So, for instance, like, yeah, I only have a battle rating 2, but I've got 5 chips here of meta currency, so when I go into combat, I can fire that autocannon.
I can right.
They're spent.
Yep.
But it's like, what does the enemy see? Oh, they just see, you know, the rating of a smaller thing, and then suddenly out of nowhere, these missiles come ripping at them, and they're like, how the hell does that little thing have that? And tell me how it has it. You've got the meta currency. Did you just duct tape and super glue an LRM pack to the backside of it and hobble together its own tracking system on
right,
the roof
right,
that's
right, right.
shaking as it's holding in place?
Yeah.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
That's great. Because, again, you don't have to think about the minutiae. You just need, like, again, break down the D&D stuff out of your head and go to the, it's just a plus one.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. It's an expendable currency.
Right.
In fact, like, again, Forge in the Dark did a great job of this. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't need to say my inventory. I just need to say that I can only carry 3.
Right. And 3 of what? I don't know. 3
don't know.
Things.
Right.
And 3 things that will significantly alter the plot.
Right. And that can change the way that combat can be simplified to just a dramatic task.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it successful or not?
Absolutely.
Or... You had brought up using mouse guard rules.
Yeah, see, I really liked the way that mouse guard does their combat, because you've kind of got, okay, so like you pair each side of the conflict off, and it's you come up with what's called a posture, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So that's calculated off of like how many people there are and what certain ratings of certain things are, and then you figure in equipment as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up to this posture total. Mm-hmm. And each turn, you then double blind choose either to attack, defend, feign, or
parry,
bluff, or something like that.
Something, yeah. Anyways, it's a move.
Yeah, it's some sort of a move, and there's 4 moves, and they interact with each other in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So if I pull attack and you pull feign, it that means we have to make certain rolls,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's a grid that basically shows what needs to happen for there. And what'll happen each round is one side, or possibly both, will lose or gain posture.
Mm-hmm.
When one side hits 0 posture, or when somebody decides to, like, flee from the engagement and
mm-hmm.
end it,
mm-hmm.
You take both posture ratings, and you look at them individually, but you also look at them in comparison to one another.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I started at 10... and decided to, like, flee the engagement when I was at 2, I've still lost 8 posture,
mm-hmm.
okay? Now, regardless of what happens there, that means that some significant damage has been done to me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we may have also taken it out of the enemy's hide as well. They might have started at 15 and ended at 2.
Right.
You know? So they technically lost more posture than us.
Right.
Because they started at 15, we only started at 10.
Right.
Right? So... each one of us is going to be looking at some consequences, but then you also compare the two, okay? So we're both ending at 2 in this hypothetical situation. That means our combat came to a draw.
Right.
Okay. However, if you obliterate them, you know, that difference may spell out, like, I mean, I've looked at the chart for it in Mouse Guard, and it's like, if you lose by more than 10 or something like that, like, pick one of your characters, they die.
Yep.
We don't care how you explain it or which one it is, but one of your characters dies.
Mm-hmm.
Write that into the narrative.
Yep. And I think that would be perfect for something like this.
I think it
sounds complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could simplify it.
I don't think it sounds complicated at all, honestly. There's only like 4 general moves.
Right. I mean, it sounds complicated,
yeah.
but I think it would simplify the rounds and rounds of combat.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, to bring it down to I do this, you do this, we check. I do this, you do this, we check. You know, until we decide we're done, or one of us is done.
Yeah.
And I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and again, stacking in there a meta currency that can change some of those odds,
mm-hmm.
I think throws a whole different level on things.
What might be interesting is almost like an ante mm-hmm. sort of thing, where like each meta currency you spend becomes a salvage that goes into the winner pool.
Yep.
You know, so like, okay, cool, I'm dumping my autocannon, but I better hope that that I win this engagement, because I just spent 3 of my meta currency and I may be kissing that goodbye.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, you lose the mech, but they gained 3 salvage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
And then the storyteller keeps a hard record of that, of like, not only did you lose an engagement, but you gave up a lot of salvage to them, so now they're going to be more powerful in this territory.
Yep.
And they may take it to the offensive, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that. I think that would be a really interesting system. I think it could be really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to stack it on anything else.
Yeah.
Right. I like it as its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That you know that this is how things are done. This mm-hmm. is the way things are handled. You know, and you don't get many options to do the other side of, like, you're not changing hearts and minds with spells or like intimidation and things like that,
mm-hmm.
right? They're looking at your numbers and you're looking at theirs. It's pretty obvious. You can't hide a 60-foot mech.
Everybody wants the same thing as you. They want to live.
Yeah. So but the thing is that mm-hmm. it's not like you don't, they're not an unknown commodity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They have 4 battle mechs, you have 2.
Yeah.
Yours are really big, but they have 4 lights. It's still there's no hiding.
Yeah. Like,
this is happening.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't mean that they can't pull something like they have another ally
mm-hmm.
that they're going to bring in on this hulk. Okay. That does
that
change
changes things,
it
yeah.
severely, you know, or even just a third party showing up because you guys are both weak.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sean saying in the live chat, maybe something like a 5 or 7 way rock, paper, scissors system. Like a rock, paper, scissors, yeah. lizard, Spock.
You could do something like that. But yeah. I honestly like the system, the burning wheel design
yeah.
of that. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We did find Salvage Union, which was a game system that had this.
Yeah, you looked at this. I didn't get a chance to look at it.
It uses Quest RPG's rules, which I'm not 100% familiar with. And mm-hmm. I only kind of glanced at it. But what I did like about it was very much like... more individual, not so much community-based,
mm-hmm.
like yours is designed. This was individuals who were trying to survive in, like, a small band and slapstick their mechs back together to keep
right,
them
right,
rolling
right.
through a wasteland,
mm-hmm.
you know, that may already be fraught with its own levels of problems, you know, that are out there.
Oh, God, you know what I might try to do?
Hmm.
I might try to throw this together in Cortex.
I think it'd be pretty easy.
I mean, nothing in Cortex is ever easy, but I might try to do it.
I could see you doing it in Cortex. The other thing that would be interesting is again, you...
A hack of Burning Wheel?
Yeah.
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 Just a straight-up hack of Burning Wheel and simplified Burning Wheel at that.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
don't need much more, so...
Right on.
But I like it. I like it a lot. I'm glad we recorded this one because I'd like to come back to some of these
yeah,
thoughts.
Yeah, I know, right? Some of these are like, I walked away from writing this show sheet going, this is really compelling, actually.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a good idea, sir. Yeah.
And honestly, I'm going to flat out say this. People who love Forge in the Dark and do game designs within it and are listening to this, have fun.
Yeah.
Like, we might get to these things. We might not. But either way, send us a message. Let us know how these systems
come
together.
Yeah, none of these yeah. ideas are... But you're not... Please steal these ideas.
Yes.
They don't belong to us. They're out in the air now.
They're out in the open now. Yes. So, Nevim had a couple questions.
Yeah, sure.
So far, which game surprised you the most?
Like, of all the ones we system spotlighted?
I think so.
Oh, God. I think I know
in a positive way or a negative way?
Well, I'm going to say positive. I'm going
to
say positive.
We'll stick to the positive.
I think Arc Doom did.
Okay.
If I'm being straight up, like, I did not know anything about Arc Doom coming into it. And what I found was a trifecta of unique, compelling, and clean gameplay with a gorgeous book.
Okay.
Honestly, every single page, every single rule, it was written very well in that all the rules were like bolded and highlighted in ways that you could easily spot them on the page. The visual clutter was cut down to a minimum. The rules themselves were very streamlined. And it had that unique angle that I've never seen before of like, yeah, there's an apocalypse coming. I don't know which. It's up to you to decide. But the game is literally time-based.
Mm-hmm.
Decide if you're going to play for a half hour, a couple hours, or, you know, or one hour, or a couple hours. Then start the clock because when your time is up, that's when the apocalypse happens.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Two come to mind for two different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Shang-Chi, Blood in the Banquet Hall.
Oh, always. Always.
It's almost like I couldn't talk enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the game so easily, at face value, could have been a racist nightmare.
Oh, it could have. A
culturist nightmare. Because if you just flipped pages through that book, you would see what you thought was Chinese menus and jokes. And like it would seem humor.
Right.
Bad humor.
Right.
But it was everything opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was, there was so much love put into not only framing and designing and explaining what was going, what the purpose of this game was, but also just to kind of bring you in for a light hug and say, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're allowed to play this in my community. You're not of my community, but I want you to experience this.
Cultural exchange is what we're looking at.
Not it's, appropriation. It's not
beautiful,
even...
Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful cultural exchange, yeah.
And I just... It surprised me at so many turns. Like, I want to go back to that. I want to tell too many people about it,
mm-hmm.
right? And even if you never play it, respect it. For God's sakes, respect that game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think the other one that surprised me on a mechanical level, for its simplicity, for the way that it blended it directly into its mechanics, was Brindlewood Bay. I'd never seen something that was so well dedicated to investigation without making it challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it said, I know what I want to be, I'm going to give you the best tools that I can to show you, and then I'm going to kind of look around for a second and say, it's a lot easier than you think, you know? And you're like, what? That's it?
Here's how you do complex mysteries.
Yeah.
You ready? Lean a little closer. It doesn't matter. Make it up as you go along.
Exactly.
But like, at the appropriate time, tell them they've figured it out and that they're right.
Yeah.
What if they guess wrong? They can't guess wrong. If they point a finger at someone, that's the guy that did it.
Yeah. Just make it work.
Yeah.
But it does it in such a way that it doesn't make assumptions of the storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it knows that you've had a bad history with other game systems.
Right.
And
right,
just kind of eases you into it. I mean, I think that Tiny D6 does that with, like, almost a blunt hammer of, mm-hmm. like, we know you've been abused, but I'm going to tell you, everything is 2D6.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
Whereas this game is just like, hey, just leave all those to the side.
Mm-hmm.
None of that. Let those wash over you. That none of that matters.
Mm-hmm.
We got you. This is simple. Let me show you how old ladies solve crimes in a chaotic world, you know? And it's like, oh my God, thank you. Thank you for treating me like a human,
right,
you know?
Right.
You know, and it's, there was so much warmth in the way that it was presented in such a simple presentation that I was blown away.
Why am I suddenly thinking of the pilot in the movie Airplane? Like, hey, Timmy, welcome to the cockpit. Timmy. You ever watch Murder, She Wrote? Timmy, have you ever read a Nancy Drew novel?
Do you like the Hardy Boys?
Do you like the Hardy Boys, Timmy?
Yes. It's a silly question to ask, but at the same time, it makes sense.
Right, like, right.
Everything just kind of checks, you know? Because we often think that it's really challenging to mm-hmm. do good investigation. And some people really do break it down, like, you know, the three-step problem and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. things like that. But, like, these people take it to a whole new level. They're
God.
We're playing tabletop here, folks.
Right,
it's a
right.
group storytelling event. There's no secrets. I'm going to tell you the truth, you know.
I recently saw some people on Reddit, I want to say, that were complaining about Quantum Ogres. The whole thing about Quantum Ogres, and someone was like, what's Quantum Ogres? And somebody badly explained it. Basically, like, oh, you just move the ogres, which takes away all the player agency. And it's like, it's not about the ogres, buddy. You know,
it's
never been about the ogres. It's about moving the important thing that needs to move the plot along into the path of the party so they can't move around it.
Right.
So the plot can continue.
Right. Like, if you assume that they're smart enough to go to the very specific place that you set up and do the very specific things.
Right.
You're wrong. You're just wrong.
The importance isn't we need them to fight ogres. The importance is we need them to know ogres are here. So we're going to put the ogres in front of them. So they go, hey guys, there's ogres here.
Yeah.
And what I love about all of that is that Brindlewood Bay, like, doesn't even do quantum ogres. Nope. It just outright says the ogres don't matter.
Right.
You know,
pick three things, present those to them,
yeah,
and then ask, effectively wait for your players to come up with some cockamamie idea.
Draw a conclusion
fits.
And go, wow, you really knocked this one out of the park, guys.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly.
Beautiful.
And then lean into it. Mm-hmm. And then just lean into it from a story aspect,
yep,
and you will get beautiful results.
The Lovecraftian aspects,
mm-hmm,
really divide the divide the crowd on this one, I find.
I think so.
How do you feel about them?
I think there are ways to do it where it's not, it doesn't turn me away.
Okay.
I think I could do it in a way that it didn't turn me away.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Lovecraftian can grace the scale between almost a Indiana Jones kind of thing, where it's just on the edge of a cult. Like, you're just seeing the edge of the veil,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really there. Or even Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he ran the edge of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit. Like, everything can be explained. You know, as Watson would say, everything can be explained by science. No, everything can be explained.
Right.
But
yeah,
oftentimes, you're right. It's just people being people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you know, and understand that there are things there that you can't explain today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the point of the matter is that some things are unexplainable, but the people are not.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that are happening with the people are not. And I think that's the key to Brindlewood Bay.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that you're going to have, like, a demon that you're going to have to figure out what's going on in their mind. That's unknown. That's never the part of the story that's ever going to be known.
Yeah, yeah. But the cult aspects, which are people,
right,
in service to this entity.
Yeah.
Those are the antagonists.
Yeah, you have all the standard things. Fear, greed,
yeah,
hate.
Yeah. So to go back to Scooby-Doo's lesson, you know?
Yeah.
Behind every monster is just some dude in a rubber mask,
yep,
just being greedy.
That's all it is.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Yep.
Protecting, being fearful, whatever it may be.
All right, so Nevim's next question here is there some movies/series/books/comics you would like to be turned into a tabletop RPG?
Yes. I will say yes. There are definitely ones that I would love to play in those worlds or in those feelings.
Mm-hmm. Wheel of Time immediately jumps out at me. I know there's been, like, a D20 version of it, and I believe there was, like, a GURPS version of it. I don't remember, but it wasn't a D20 version. But I've yet to see a good version of it that I want to play.
Yeah.
You know?
Discworld was the one that jumped into my head frame.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's fantasy in such a, like, interesting light. Like, contemporary edged light.
The only problem I would have with playing any sort of Discworld is that my storyteller would need to be Sir Terry Pratchett, GNU.
Yeah.
Or I don't think you would do it justice. Like, you would need to be the biggest mega fan to evoke the feel of Discworld.
Correct.
Because it's supremely unique.
It is every aspect of it is taken in such an oddly serious light.
Mm-hmm.
And I say oddly serious,
mm-hmm,
because it treats itself as serious, but when you look at it, it's not. It's satire of existence.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and comedy and things like that. But, like, to play in Discworld is to be satire of reality. And I think that is an amazing edge. Like, Tune is such a weird romp to try and exist in,
mm-hmm,
as a game system. I think this would sit in that same framework of something that is ridiculous, yet easily identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the concept that someone wants effectively Santa Claus killed,
right?
And he's just like, well, where would you find him? You can ask any kid on any street corner at any time, and he will give you an approximate location of where his home is,
right,
and where he will be on any given night,
right?
And it's like, Okay, that's fair.
And because of how folklore works,
yeah,
that will be truth.
It's
because
he
exists in the hearts of children.
Correct. You know? He exists.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? I bet you've thought about killing Death. I've actually had some ideas on it. Oh,
okay. I've got plans drawn up. They're in the beta phase, but
you know, but it's there. But that right there is how that world works.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
if you just took it to an individual's level of like a guard of Ankh-Morpork,
yeah.
Is that right? Yes. Or a wizard, a lesser wizard,
mm-hmm.
you know, who doesn't have their hat yet. You know, you take it down
mm-hmm.
to those types of levels, you know, now you can have a story that's a little grittier or a little weirder,
mm-hmm.
you know, where these pressures that are above them and around them are forcing them in a direction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be as fantifical as some of the stories.
Yeah, sure.
But it could definitely fit. And all of the ridiculousness sits right there on top of it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's that level of satire,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's just tongue-in-cheek enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the going postal is a two-parter that I highly recommend anybody go and watch. But all of the movies, I think that, short of the animations, I'm going to skip those, did such a great job
mm-hmm.
of portraying it. And seeing Terry Pratchett in them was even better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I think it's a beautiful thing that that they even got the chance to do that. So for me, that would be an interesting one, more than anything, to try and get into. I think the only other one that kind of comes into my headspace, just because it has an interesting harbor in my heart, is Battle Angel Atla. That
Alita?
Alita. And,
yeah.
Or, I've always known it as Atla in my head. But it's such a weird world that an understanding of self and what it means to be alive in that world
mm-hmm.
for as long as some entities are
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and how much has changed and who's in power and what power really means.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and when you have that for thousands of years, what does it do to you?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think Numenera could have done that.
Yeah, Numenera could have been a lot of things.
But at the same time, like, I think the setting-wise, you
mm-hmm.
know, could have felt in a direction. But I don't think any dystopian cyberpunk touches even close to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not talking about a civilization that's fallen. We're talking about a civilization that rose, fell, had war, fell, rose, fell. Okay, now everyone who's rich just lives above the trash
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And even they have something that sits higher than them
mm-hmm.
that they don't even think about, that they know isn't a god, but pretty much acts like one.
Right, right, right.
And like that tiered society and mm-hmm. how much bleeds from the top to the bottom,
mm-hmm.
you know, it almost comes back to old Greek stories of gods playing with mortals.
And things being cast off of Olympus. Yeah.
Exactly, because they're bored or because they throw things away, mm-hmm. and they're effectively throwing away something that is unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, that wouldn't be bad, actually, come to think. Like, something like a Hades.
Yeah.
You know, taking the characterizations of a lot of the gods and stuff like that from the video game Hades mm-hmm. and turning that into some sort of an RP system.
Well, we've got somebody in our Discord who's kind of playing around with gods and,
yeah.
and such. So I'm not going to get too far into that. If you're interested, please join our Discord. There's some conversations being had. But anyways, I think those are the ones that really kick around in my head.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. So next week's topic,
yes.
We're going to be talking about dessert in storytelling.
Yes.
Just a little treat.
Yes.
Because you deserve it.
Yeah.
But really, we're talking about those moments where you just kind of step away from being ultra super serious and like mm-hmm. furthering the plot and stuff like that. You know, allow yourself a Battle of the Bands episode. Allow yourself a moment to have just a couple of NPCs do some character bits.
Yeah, not necessarily the mechanical downtime that the games give you.
Right, right,
but like a legitimate time where storytelling isn't attached to the plot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It is where everything else lives. It's where you become bound to the world
right,
as a player.
Right.
and what does that mean? What does it look like, and how does it feel?
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right. Well, you can find us on Twitter at @ST_conclave, on Instagram at @ST_conclave. Listen to us live every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern time on mixlr.com/storyteller-conclave. And join us up on our Discord. We'd love to hear from you there. Talk to the other great storytellers that are on that Discord. You can find that link on our Twitter as well as our website, storytellerconclave.com.
We'd like to thank our Patreon members who help us out every single month, especially our name members, Knox in the Box, Subject, The Arcane Asylum, Hulavu, Sam, Sean, and Sparkle Motion. We appreciate all your support. Our pre-show music is by Arcane Anthems. You can find them on Instagram or Patreon as Arcane Anthems. Our intro music, which you're hearing right now, is Beyond the Warriors by Geefrog. You can find them at geefrog.bandcamp.com. And our outro music, which you're hearing right now, is Only Our Footprints in the Sand by Midair Machine. You can find them at freemusicarchive.org.
And a big shout out, as always, to our families, Vicky and Sean. Thank you so much for loving and supporting us. All of our friends who've sat with us at our tables to give you these great stories to share with you over the years. And you, every single one of our listeners, we love you guys so much.
Love you.
Good night.